Well, this morning we come back to Genesis chapter 47. We're now late into the famine. Pharaoh had dreamt about. Joseph is altogether powerful in the land of Egypt. He's brought his family to Egypt for shelter, provision, safety, and he's done so by God's will. We know that because God spoke to Jacob in dreams and told him not to be afraid to go to Egypt. He told him he would make him into a great nation there in Egypt. He told Jacob that he himself would go down with him to Egypt and would bring him back up again. But he let him know that the way he'd bring him back up isn't the way he'd go down, that his son Joseph would be the one who would close his eyes, that he was going to die in Egypt. And so Jacob and the family of Israel made the journey, 70 people in total. And it was funny, everyone always laughs at the chapters I give to the young guys to preach always have, the names and all of the different things in there. They think that I planned that on purpose. But anyway, you got to know all of the names, all of the people that were going down, 70. To think that 430 years later, between 1 and 2 million of Jacob's family would come out in the Exodus. God certainly fulfilled his promises, didn't he? Last week, we read of the beautiful scene where Israel and Joseph are reunited. And then we saw how Joseph prepared his family to meet Pharaoh. You know, Joseph knows the ropes there in Egypt, and so he wants to make sure they don't misstate anything, because in his mind he knows exactly where they should settle. And he's got a reason why. And so he gives them the script. He says, when Pharaoh asks about your occupation, we're keepers of livestock since our youth. And so He's managing this in order for them to be able to settle and to dwell in Goshen, away from the influence and culture of the Egyptians. And so we come to chapter 47, beginning with verse 1. We've been doing full chapters at a time, but this one kind of stopped me in my tracks. And so we're all going to stop and just do the first 12 verses here. So Joseph went in and told Pharaoh, my father and my brothers with their flocks and herds and all that they possess have come from the land of Canaan, and they're now in the land of Goshen. And from among his brothers, he took 5 men and he presented them to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to his brothers, what is your occupation? They said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds as our fathers were. They said to Pharaoh, we've come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. And now, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you, and the land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them settle in the land of Goshen. And if you know any able men among them, put them in charge of my livestock. Then Joseph brought in Jacob, his father, and stood him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many are the days of the years of your life? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life. And they've not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their sojourning. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh when he went out from the presence of Pharaoh. Then Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession of the land of Egypt and the best of the land and the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had commanded. And Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with food according to the number of their dependents. So Joseph went in and told Pharaoh that his father and his brothers, family, flocks, herds, everything that they own, it's all here. It's all come in from the land of Canaan. And they were now staying in the land of Goshen. And he wanted to let them know. And he made a point to have them stay there so that they were already in place. Why here? Why Goshen? I believe that there's both a physical reason and a spiritual reason. First, the physical. Goshen is on the far northwestern edge. If you see a map of Egypt, it's right up here on the corner. And so it's on its way back towards Israel. It's on the very edge of the Nile River Basin, so there's fertile land. It's perfect for raising livestock. It's got rolling hills. It's got two major freshwater lakes that always have been there, and they've always been filled with fish. It's some distance from the Nile River, and it's a distance from the rivers that are feeding in and out of the Nile River. Why is that important? Because when you look at a map of Egypt, all of the population centers in Egypt tend to follow the river and the riverways. And so what you find is Goshen is away from that. It's away from the population centers. Not only that is if you look on a map and you see the trade routes, there's no trade routes that go through Goshen. If you're going to Goshen, it's because you're going to Goshen. You're not going to pass through Goshen going anywhere else. It's a destination of itself. And so you have to figure that if his family is there in this place with fresh water, fish, rolling pasture land, hills, and everything else, and it's kind of on the way back home to Israel, why would anyone go to Goshen? The Egyptians hate shepherds and flocks. These are foreign shepherds that are in this area. It would be a place that everyone would stay away from. And so physically, the reason that Goshen made sense was it would keep them isolated and insulated from the culture and the pressures of everything around them. What had Joseph come to know about his brothers? How influenced were they in Canaan? They picked up Canaan wives. They were kind of following along with the culture. So he wanted them to be isolated and insulated from the Egyptian culture and people. So that is physically why Goshen was such a great place. Spiritually, why was it such a great place? The word in Hebrew means to draw near, to approach. It would be here that the people of Israel would be taught how to draw near and how to approach God. So far to this point, they haven't been doing a great job of it. They would be humbled here. They would come into bondage and affliction here. They would be fruitful here. And they would be rescued here, led home from here. 430 years they would spend in this place as God multiplied their numbers and made them into a people, his people, Israel. So Joseph brought them to Goshen, and then he works the ropes to ensure that they're able to stay there. If you remember from the last chapter, he scripted for his brothers what they were to say to Pharaoh when they met him. And so now in verse 2, we have the meeting. Now look at who Joseph brings. He doesn't bring all of his brothers. He only brings five of his brothers. And what's maybe not in your translation, but that's kind of cool in the Hebrew, is that he brings the least of his five brothers. The word is the least of them. Now, what does that mean? It could mean that it was the youngest five. It could mean it was the weakest five. Could mean both of those things. The idea is he brought the least of his brothers. You know, you find that he doesn't bring Judah. He doesn't bring Reuben, Simeon, the strong brothers. He brings the lesser, the weaker brothers. And so why do you think that he does that? If you start to understand this, you're going to see that from the questioning and from what Pharaoh says, you're going to understand why he brings in the weak brothers with him to Pharaoh. Pharaoh asks the five brothers their occupation. Literally what he asks them is this: what is it that you do? That was the way it was asked. What is it that you've been doing? What are the deeds that you've done? Boy, is that an open-ended question. Do you understand why Joseph gave them a script to follow? Because those boys could have said anything if we think back over the last, 25 years. They answer as instructed. Your servants are shepherds as our fathers were. Right? They go exactly on the script. And then they let him know what they're hoping for. We've come here because of the famine. The land is desolate up in Canaan, and so we've come here hoping that we might be able to stay in the good pasture land of Goshen. Now, what's interesting is if you remember back in chapter 45, when Pharaoh first heard that Joseph's brothers were there, what did he tell Joseph? He said, tell your brothers and your father to come here and they can have anything they want. Go fetch your brothers. They can live wherever they want. And Joseph knows, though, one thing. With a Pharaoh, things can change, right? And so he doesn't presume upon that previous thing that the Pharaoh said. He knows this Pharaoh. So he doesn't presume upon that. And so he wants to make sure that how they respond, if approached, that they're going to approach this whole thing correctly. And so he's working under the direction of God. He knows what God wants. And so he's trying to fulfill all of these things together. And so he's acting methodically, knowing that God is at work, even in Pharaoh's heart. A side note. I always point these out because I think it's important. If you were writing a religion, Think about Moses. He's writing to the people of Israel before they go into the land of promise. And right here in this book, he's writing about the Egyptians, the horrible Egyptians, the Egyptians that have kept us in bondage, the Egyptians that were killing our people, the ones that were making us make bricks without straw, these Egyptians that were chasing us into the Red Sea, these Egyptians. If this was written by men, you wouldn't find one good thing ever written about an Egyptian. This is God's book. And what you find is this Pharaoh is a good Pharaoh. He's kind. He's honest. He has integrity. Luther goes as far as to say that he's a saved man. No one else agrees with Luther. But Luther thinks that Joseph got to him and that somehow he's even convicted. I don't see that in the scripture, but what I do see is that I see that he was moved by God in his heart to favor Joseph. And there was a genuine affection for Joseph and for his family. So Pharaoh tells Joseph, the land is before you. Take the best of the land. Have them settle in Goshen. It's now an edict. Now those people have that land. It's their land. What's interesting is you're going to see later that Joseph is going to do stuff as the famine continues that are going to take all of the rest of the people that were in the land out of the land, and he's going to move them all into cities. So the only people that are going to be living out in the boondocks, Hebrews, Israel. Anyway, listen to the last comment that the Pharaoh makes. And if you know any able men is the word in the Hebrew, is there anyone that's capable with integrity? What he's asking him is there any more like you? Right? What he's hoping of is if he gets Joseph here, and Joseph is such a great leader and such a great manager, think about how Egypt has been blessed under his leadership. What he wants is, are there any more like you at home? If there are, bring them and let me put them in charge of my livestock. Let me put them in charge of other things. Joseph knew that. That's why he brought the weak brothers, the young brothers, the ones that didn't have experience. And so you can tell that when he says, and if you know any capable men, it tells you he's looking at his brothers going, not like these. Right? And so Joseph is smart. He's planned it all out. Why? Because he wants to keep the family together. He knew that Pharaoh would be looking for more men like him. So the family of Israel is now given the land of Goshen to serve there. It's got freshwater lakes. It's got water. It's got fish. It's got rolling hills, space to grow, isolated, insulated from the culture around them. Just great. Then we come to the next person that Joseph introduces. The person Joseph probably most loves in the world, his dad. And he brings his dad in and he presents his dad. It says he stands his dad before Pharaoh. Here's my dad. Do you know what Jacob does? And we, because of our culture, probably don't understand this as much. He blesses Pharaoh before Pharaoh speaks. Can you imagine this old man comes into the court? Pharaoh would be in all of his regalia. He's sitting on his throne. He's got his scepter in his hand. He's got his staff. He's got his cupbearers. He's got all the folks that are in there. His whole court. And here comes this old man, 130 years old, and his shepherd probably smells like sheep. And before he even speaks, he calls a blessing upon the Pharaoh. It's amazing. Tells you something about Jacob. Jacob was not impressed with him. You know, and it's interesting. If you remember, if you go back in Genesis, when the king of Salem, you know, here's Abraham, God's Abraham, and he's gone and he's won all these battles. But all of a sudden we're introduced to this priest, Melchizedek. He's the king of Salem. He's the priest of the Most High God. Do you remember what he does when he meets Abraham? He blesses him. Abraham recognizes his authority. And what does he do? He pays tribute to him. We're told in Hebrews 7:7 that it's beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. So what are you seeing here? When Jacob comes into Pharaoh and blesses him, there's an inference. Who's higher? Pharaoh was a prince among men. But Jacob knew that he was a prince of the Most High God. And here Jacob greets Pharaoh with an invocation of blessing from his God, the Most High, the God who told Jacob he would be with him even down in Egypt. What's interesting is this Pharaoh had already been blessed greatly through Joseph. His trust, his affection for God's man. But here he receives a blessing at the hand of Jacob. You can hear a favorable response of respect and welcome. He's not offended. I'm sure everyone kind of holds their breath. What's Pharaoh going to do with this? And his answer is, so how many days of the years are you? Of life are you, right? That's what he's asking. It's like, man, how old are you? What's interesting is you look at this, an interesting question. First off, the way it's asked with a profound respect. It's a recognition of his age, his wisdom, even his position. There's a deference to it as the way he asks it. But it's not just a question of how old are you? I want you to understand that in the idiom of this, he's asking about not just the quantity of his life. He's asking the quality of his life. So, how many are the days of the years of your life? You're not just asking, how old are you? So, what's your life been like? How have you lived your life? What's the quality of your life been? What have you seen? What have you done? What have you learned? The Jewish commentators remark that due to Jacob's hard life, exposed to the elements, he would look even older than he was at 130. Egyptians didn't live much past 70. And so his age would have been remarkable and it would have set him apart. Now, what's interesting about his response is we expect the first part, right? His response and when he talks about his age. But I think the second part surprises us. It surprised me. First part, he tells Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years. I want you to understand he changes it because the Pharaoh says, how many are the days or the years of your life? Jacob corrects him. The days of the years of my pilgrimage, my sojourning, is 130 years. What is he saying with that? It's one of the points that I want you to take home with you today. What is he saying when he says this is a sojourning? Well, the word translates into pilgrimage, but if you take it out even further, it's traveling through a temporary place to live. That's not your home. See, Pharaoh says, this is your life. How long have you lived on the earth? What Jacob wants him to know, this isn't my home. I'm just visiting. I'm just traveling through. I'm a sojourner. I'm on a pilgrimage. In Hebrews, it's described, remember Abraham, turn to Hebrews chapter 11. Read it for you this morning in the thing, 11, 9 and 10. Talking about Abraham, it says, by faith he went to live in the land of promise as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For, look at this, he was looking forward to the city that has foundations whose designer and builder is God. This ain't it. Right? What you find out from Abraham is very quickly he understood, this isn't it. This isn't all there is. And then if you would turn to 13, now it goes beyond that. It includes, you know, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac, Jacob. It says, these all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak this way make it clear that they're seeking a homeland. If they'd been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have an opportunity to return. But no, as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. What do all of these people of faith know? This is not their home. They're sojourning here. This place is not their home. He knew God had a better country. He had planned it out. He was preparing a city that was not built with human hands. Do you remember how Jesus encouraged his disciples when he was getting near to his departure? John 14:3 says, "I go to prepare a place for you. I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also." Jacob recognized that this life is spent on this fallen earth. It's a fallen earth. We who are God's people, people of promise, we live as pilgrims here, sojourners here. On the back of a bunch of trucks, I see the NOTW. Have you ever seen that on the back of the window? For a long time, I'm like, what is the NOTW? Well, you know what it means? It means not of this world. You know, most of the people that have that sticker don't really understand what it means. It's a good sticker. I'm just traveling through. I'm just a sojourner here. I'm not of this place. I'm of that place. There's a homeland. There's a place being prepared for me. This is not our home. This is not all there is. This is not the final cut. You know what this is? This is a proving ground. This is the place where you're going to receive God's love and believe and trust, or this is the place where you're going to reject God's love and come to ruin. This is not it. Do you know what it is? Turn with me to over a little bit to the right, Revelation 21. Revelation 21. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He'll wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away.' And he who was seated on the throne said, 'Behold, I'm making all things new.'" He said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." Trustworthy and true, beloved. You know who the one that's sitting? Jesus is telling you this is trustworthy and true. He is preparing a place for you. This isn't it. This isn't the place that we invest everything. You know, that's our destination. That's our home. You know, that before we get there, some of us will spend some time in heaven, face to face with our Savior, a place Jesus told the thief that he called it paradise. Paul taught us that to live is Christ and to die is gain, and he was torn between laboring here to depart and be with Christ, which is what, he said, far better. So we know heaven is going to be far better, and so that's kind of our holding place. A lot of people think, wow, I'm going to spend eternity in heaven. No, you're not. You're going to be spending time in heaven while you're waiting for Christ to return, and once Christ returns, then he's going to make all things new. There's going to be a new heavens and a new earth, and this new heaven and new earth is going to have no corruption in it. There'll be no sin in it. There'll be no pain, no death. It'll be the heaven and earth that he had always desired for the people of his own, the one that he loved so much. In any case, heaven's a wonderful place to wait until that day when God recreates the heavens and the earth. We're reunited with our glorified, resurrected bodies. And guess what? Not only is it a place that's not corrupted, in our resurrected bodies, we are no longer corrupted. It's a place where we will no longer sin, feel pain, sorrow. He's preparing it for you right now. Do you know that to be true? He told us it's a trustworthy and true statement. Do you know that the Puritans, they talked about it all the time with each other. They talked about the next life, the next world. They talked about what was waiting for them. And they lived and they fretted over making this life as much as it could be. Not so that, oh, I'm going to have all the toys and I'm going to eat a big bite out of this life. No, it was because it was for that world. They lived and they worked for that world, not this one. That's our permanent home. So here's a point I want you to take home with you today. Which world are you living for? Longing for? Holding on tightly to? this corrupted world that's full of sin and evil, hurt, pain, hatred, death? Or are you holding to the world that he's preparing with no sin, righteousness, peace, his presence, life? I think all of us hold too tightly to this life. You know, when I talk to people that are dealing with anxiousness and they're getting stressed out about things, when I take them in my office, we start talking. Do you know what they're stressed out about? Their lifestyle more than their life. They trust God for their shelter. They trust God for their salvation. They trust God for their food. They trust God. No. It's my lifestyle. It's my rights as an American citizen. It's my right. It's all these things that are tied to this life. My stuff. I always stop and say, have you thought about the next life? I'm going to wait till I'm dead and then I'll think about that. There's a problem with that thinking. The time to think about that life is now, as Jacob is going to teach us today. We strive, we worry, we stress, we toil so long for this world. Beloved, it's not our home. I want you to start thinking about this life, what you've got left, as a proving ground. It's a place where God proves his love for you. It's not so much your proving ground to him as much as his proving ground to you. It's a place where you are going to find him, believe him, trust him, hold fast to him, or it's a place where you're going to reject him and regret it. We ought to get that pilgrimage mindset back into the church. So, that's what Jacob captured in this first remark. This isn't my home. This isn't my life. But I know what you're asking me, and the length of time of my sojournings is 130 years. It's an expected response. The second response is unexpected. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of my fathers in the days of their sojourning. You can imagine everyone in the whole place going, whoa, wasn't expecting to hear that. First off, the last part is Jacob's confession that his life is not compared to that of his father and grandfather, not just in years, but in quality, faithfulness. I haven't done anything that my father and grandfather have done, not accomplished any of it. Their faithfulness, everything else, that hasn't been the characteristic of my life. Hasn't attained to any of that. Few and evil is how I would characterize my life. Few, first off, few, the days of the years. And when you ask the days of the years, what you're asking is, so what are your accomplishments? What have you learned? What have you done? What, tell me about the good days. And this word that he uses for few is diminished, insignificant, amount to little, not much. Not much have I learned. Not much have I done. I've wasted a lot of time. Diminished. But the one that really hits home for me, I'm sure many of you, evil. Now, it's not evil in the sense like, no, I want you to understand that the Hebrew word in the Hebrew is translated to mean unpleasant, bad, trials, hardship, painful, misery, affliction. One of the commentators I really like said, you can really sum it up with struggle. And when you think of Jacob, struggle. My life has been a battle. My years are unremarkable and insignificant. And my life has been hard, a constant trial with much hardship, pain, and struggle. Now, when I first read that, it was like, it took me back. I'm like, that's not what you would tell the Pharaoh. You would say, God is great. I'm here to tell you that God has made a huge impact in my life. And let me share with you how great God is. My life has been horrible. It's been insignificant. And I've always been on the wrong side of God's will and just about everything. And so I had to go back. And so I'm going to take you back with me. Genesis 25:22, inside his mother's womb, what was Jacob doing? Struggling with his brother, remember? He struggled in the womb. Genesis 25:26, he comes out grabbing hold of his brother's heel. Not without me, you're not going. Which is why he got named that. Heel grabber. Right? Foot twister. You know what that means? Oh man, I'm pulling your leg. What does that mean? I'm someone who has a little bit of a light relationship with the truth, right? He's a deceiver. His name is deceiver. Cheater. From birth. He grew up knowing that his dad loved his brother more. His whole life was a competition with his brother who could gain his father's love. He and his brother fought all the time, competed all the time. We were told of the story where he manipulates his brother out of his birthright. Why? Because he's someone who always takes matters into his own hands, doesn't he? You watch him all the way through his life. I got this. I know how to fix this. Let me do this. He jumps in, takes matters into his own hands, deceives his brother, takes the birthright for himself. God had already promised him the birthright, right? Promise it to his mother. It's yours. No, I don't trust you. I'm going to take it myself and make sure because I don't think you're paying attention. Genesis 27. Thinking that he's going to lose what God had promised, which tells you where his faith was, faithless. He and his mother step in to fix things. And so what does he do? He deceives his dying father. Takes his birthright again for himself. Now he's hated by his brother even more than he was before. He's sent away to save his own life because his brother has vowed to kill him. And we find that he's never going to see his mom alive again. The one who had always loved him, the one that he was closest with. Doesn't get to see her. Where is he sent? To his uncle's house. If you think Jacob is a deceiver and a cheat, wait till you meet Uncle Laban. He's sent to a real cheat and a real manipulator's house. And you can imagine that from the day he arrived, guess what a cheater and a liar knows? Other cheaters and liars. From day one, he knew what his uncle was. Every day he was on guard. There was never rest in his uncle's house for the next 20 years of his life. But while he's there, he falls in love with a girl, Rachel, his daughter. She's beautiful. You can have her for 7 years. This is relatives. He's going to have to work 7 years to get her. And at the end of 7 years, what happens? He's deceived. He wakes up with Leah. He doesn't love Leah. God does. He doesn't. He goes back to his dad or his uncle and says, I want Rachel. This is work for me 7 more years. You can have Rachel. So he does. And now he has Rachel and Leah. Do they get along? Oh, no. They're in constant competition. Is Rachel's womb opened? Oh, no. Leah's. Does that make Rachel happy? No. Rachel, his beloved, is unhappy. And if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy, right? And so in this home, with these two wives, we find throughout the raising of his boys, nothing but competition and discord and dysfunction all the way around. They bring in the servants and just complicate matters even more. Then she has Joseph. Ah, Joseph finally has his son. He loves his Joseph. Finally gets the courage. Let's get out of here. Let's go. God says, go ahead and go. He leaves. But as he leaves, Laban and his sons hate him. They chase after him. They're going to kill him. And so he has to flee away from his uncle's house. And if it wasn't for God's intervention, probably would have been killed. Finally gets away from his uncle's house. And what's he filled with? Joy, peace, because he's going back home. No, fear and anxiousness, because now he's going back home where his brother wants to kill him. And as he makes the journey back over to come, he has this encounter with God and he struggles and he wrestles with God. And you know what? It's a painful struggle. He ends up crippled. Yeah, he comes to know God's name, but it's a painful coming to know it. Everything in his life is a struggle. As they get closer coming into the land, his wife, Rachel, at a young age, giving birth to Benjamin, dies. He buries her on the road. Soon after he gets news, his father, Isaac, has died. He's not going to get this. He gets into the land. at least he's got Joseph. Good old Joseph. He loves Joseph. And probably for a few years there was this wonderful relationship with Joseph. But the older boys are bad and they do nothing but harass and badger and bully this poor, wonderful son of his. Until at 17, one of the servants walks in with a bloody coat of Joseph. And then the brothers walk in with suspicious looks on their faces. He loses his beloved son, torn up by beasts, maybe. I think not only did he lose that son, I think he lost all of his sons that day because his trust in them was never the same. A little bit later, his oldest son sleeps with his wife. On the way back, you remember his daughter? She gets raped. And then his number two and number three sons, they go into this murderous rage and they completely butcher an entire city, making them a pariah across the entire land. So now everybody hates us. We're told that his wages were changed all the time when he was with Laban. He had nothing but sleepless nights. He was freezing at night. He was hot and overheated during the day. During the time when he gets back to the land, it's just fraught with droughts and famines. His sons are a mess. Judah, his fourth son, walks away from the Lord, marries a Canaanite girl, has children with a Canaanite girl. Not only that, she dies. He ends up with a prostitute that turns out to be his daughter-in-law, who then just makes her son his son. Ugly stuff, folks. Ugly stuff. It's a mess. Jacob's life was hard. It was a struggle every day. He's honest with Pharaoh. The days of the years of my life have been few and evil, insignificant and hard, not worth much, and a constant struggle. It's much less than the lives of my father and my grandfather. It's nothing like their life. Beloved, how many of us, if we were honest this morning, might answer in a similar way? Seeing how often we've been on the wrong side of God's will. Realizing how much we took matters into our own hands out of our faithlessness, not trusting God. How many nights have we walked the halls figuring out what we were going to do to protect ourselves and not once trusting Him who said He would watch over us. Our relationship with God, it's been so often a struggle just to hold on to His name. The days of our years not amounting to much with regard to God's value, the way God would value things. How many of you today would say, you know what, I've made great use of every day of my life. I've done great things for the kingdom. I can look back and say, wow, Lord, what a full and fruitful life for You. I have lived for that day when I'm going to be in Your presence. Or how many of us would say, how about we don't look at the last 55 years? There's about 20 good days in those 55 years. Many that don't amount to much. Lots of struggle, lots of heartache. Lots of hard work, lots of sorrow, so many self-inflicted wounds I can't even begin to tell you. Well, beloved, there's two things I want you to go home with today. First, He ain't dead yet. It's important in this spot right here, because guess what? He ain't dead yet. Second, He is so loved by God. And that combination ends well for Jacob. Consider Malachi 1, 2 to 3. We're told that God loved Jacob even when he was in the womb. God has loved Jacob before time. God has always loved Jacob. He loves him now. He will love him forevermore. Genesis 28, 12 to 17, the Lord watched over, protected his family. The Lord sent angels back and forth, ahead and after him. The Lord moved in the hearts and minds of those that were around him. In Genesis 31, we're told that after 20 years of Laban's control, God told him, it's time to go back to your father's land. And what did he tell him when you go back there? What did God say? I will go with you. I will always be with you. Remember when he was on the first wave, when he was going into Laban's hand, he says, I will be with you. I will complete everything that I start with you. You can count on me always being there. Genesis 32, 25 to 31. Turn there with me. 25. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket. And Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Yeah, he'd never be the same after that wrestling match. He'd struggle with God, but God was gonna make sure he knew that he'd spent time with God. He said, let me go, for the day is broken. Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. He said, what's your name? And he said, Jacob. And then he said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you've striven with God, and you've striven with men, and you've prevailed. And Jacob asked him, please tell me your name. He said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, I've seen God face to face, and my life has been delivered. The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. Everywhere Jacob went, his God went with him, watched over him, protected him, spoke to him, wrestled with him, blessed him. This life is hard. It's been sorrow. It's been pain. It's been struggle, heartache. The one my mom that I loved, I left. Never saw her again. My wife that I loved was taken when I was young. My son at 17 was ripped out of my arms. My son who slept with my wife, my two sons who butchered a town, my son who fell away from the Lord. But Jacob would look you in the eye and say, never once though was I alone. Never once did I have to go through one of those things by myself. He has always been with me. Protected me. He's watched over me. And he's got purpose and plan in all of those things. If Jacob's life had been easy, I'm not sure how close he would have been with him at the end. But God kept his eyes firmly fixed, kept him in a place where he was watchful and listening. The Lord never left his side. Do you know why? God loved him. Always had. Always will. And here, he's 130 in front of the most powerful king on the earth, blessing him. And beloved, he's not dead yet. He's going to have 17 more years that he's going to live in Egypt. And you know what he's going to see in those 17 years? He's going to see all 12 of his boys reconciled to the Lord. He's going to see them become giants, foundation stones in God's kingdom. He's going to see his sons redeemed and reconciled and changed and transformed. Do you know that he even makes it into the Hall of Fame? The Faith Hall of Fame in Hebrews 11. By the skin of his teeth. Hebrews 11, 21. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying... When he was dying, he blessed each of his sons of Joseph. And then what did he do? He bowed in worship over the head of his staff. He praised God for this life. We'll look at that scene next week. Beloved, what I want you to understand this morning, that Jacob knew the Lord. Jacob knew his name. Jacob knew him to be his God. He knew that this was a God who would keep his promises. He was a man who knew God's presence. He was a man that knew that this life was a proving ground. He knew that this place was not his home. this was not all there is. But I will tell you the honest truth this morning. He struggled in it. He struggled on this pilgrimage. Yet Jacob the deceiver was renamed by God his Israel, the one who struggled. He struggled with God and he struggled with man, but he prevailed because God was with him, because God loved him. Beloved, however you might describe the days or the years of your sojourning so far, two things to leave here today with. You ain't dead yet. That's a good thing. And second, he loves you. He's loved you for all time. And he will love you into eternity. You can count on it. And because of those two things, the mighty God of Israel loves you. Stop treating this place like it's your home. Stop living for it. Stop striving so. Start living in faith, longing for your true home. The one that's not built by hands. The one that's being prepared for you even now. Don't look back. Few and evil. What's tomorrow going to bring? Amen.